On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. For millions of Americans in love with a little fictional corner of Minnesota, Saturday night is Prairie Home Companion Night, and Garrison Keillor is the man who keeps the lamplight burning, an old-fashioned master of storytelling and the radio review who plucks at mystic chords of memory until powder milk biscuits and the Chatterbox Cafe pop out. For decades now, he's been at it, on the air, in print, and lately on the big screen. Some call him the new Mark Twain. He's out with a new book called Pontoon. Up next on Point, a conversation with the Prairie Home Companion's Garrison Keillor. Joining me now from Minneapolis is Garrison Keillor, humorist, master storyteller, host, and writer of A Prairie Home Companion, now in its 33rd year. Thank you very much for being here.
Hey, Tom. Good to be with you. That's a lovely piece of music you're playing there. Was that your theme song?
It's not at all. It sounded more like yours, so we plucked it right out of the air.
Oh, late last night, in the pale moonlight, all the vegetables had a spree.
Oh, my.
Rolled out a sign saying, dancing at 9, and all the admission was free. Martin, Bogan, and Armstrong there.
Get your finger clicking. We hear it. I don't even know
The Barnyard Dance. That's the name of it.
We love it. Okay. We love it. Listen, right.
When you get to be my age, yeah. you need to remember these things. Otherwise, it gives you a queasy feeling. If you hear a tune, you have to be able to say the title of it. Otherwise, it ruins your day. So I'm all set now.
Next step, a walker and a drool cup. If you
can't. No. Thank you. Thanks for the thought.
Sure. Listen. Yeah. Speaking of, that thought toward the great hereafter, I wonder if you'd be good enough just to dive right into your new book, Pontoon, and give us just a sense of it right from the top. Could you read for us?
This book right here?
Yes, sir.
Oh, well, I could probably do that. I noticed looking at it here, there's a word I'm not sure how to pronounce. I mean, I use it when I'm writing. But I wouldn't ever use it on the radio, and it's either serpentine or serpentine.
Well, have it your way, and we'll...
What is your way? What's your thought here? Serpentine. Isn't there a walk in a park in London called the Serpentine?
With shrubbery animals.
Yeah. I mean, you're in Boston. How do they pronounce it there? Or don't you use that term, serpentine?
You know, I mean, I hear it both ways. I'm a Midwest kid, but I think it goes both ways even in the Midwest. Let's say serpentine. We can talk about serpentine later.
Yeah, serpentine would confuse it with turpentine.
Yeah, exactly. And maybe pitchforks.
Which might lead people to think of turpitude. would get us off to a bad start. Okay, serpentine, all right.
Oh, it's a Friday night in July in Garrison Keillor's world in Pontoon, and take us away.
Mm. Evelyn was an insomniac, so when they say she died in her sleep, you have to question that. Probably she was sitting propped up in bed reading and heard the brush of wings and smelled the cold, clean air, and the angel appeared like a deer in the bedroom. And Evelyn said, "Not yet, I have to finish this book." And the angel shook his golden locks, which made a skittery sound like dry seed pods. And he laughed, a long, silent laugh, and took her pale hand in his. He'd heard that line, "not yet," before. He was always interrupting people who were engrossed in their work or getting ready for a night at the opera or about to set off on a trip. Evelyn's brother died after his wife sprayed the house with a rose-scented room freshener that made Frank sneeze so hard he had a coronary. But he made it to the phone and called the office and told them he'd be late and then lay down and died. The angel took Evelyn's hand gently in his cool hand, and off she went with him, leaving behind the book, her bed, and the blue-knit coverlet, her stucco bungalow in Lake Wobegon, redolent of coffee and fresh-picked strawberries, her bedside radio, her subscription to The New Yorker, paid through the end of the year. It had been a good wet summer, plenty of rain, and as she drifted out her back door, she noted how green the grass was. A cat announced itself from the shadows. The smell of burning charcoal hung in the air. A red ball lay by the walk. She wanted to pick it up and throw it, but the angel rose and she with him, and hand in hand they flew up into the sequined sky. The little town arranged below, all shushed and dozy, the double row of street lights on Main Street, the red light blinking on the water tower, the dark fastness of the lake, the pinpricks of lights from houses where they all slept, the cranks, the stoics, the meek, the ragtag dreamers, the drunks, the martyred wives. And she saw a woman's pale face at a window looking for evildoers, and the single pair of headlights threading the serpentine county road. And after that, she did not look down. She flew up through a meringue cloud into the mind of God, and the embrace of her sainted ancestors all gathered at her grandfather Crandall's farmhouse on a summer morn, the patient horses standing in the shade of a red oak tree, white chickens pecking for bugs under the lilacs, grandma whistling in the milk house, holding a pan of cream, the windbreak of pine and red oak, the weathered sheds and barn, the hayfields of heaven.
Garrison,
wake up, Tom.
I'm going to heaven with you, Garrison. I'm awake. I'm here. The new book is Pontoon. You know, I've got so many questions jump up out of that. Life and death, and how you like to do things. You're reading there, but you don't read in your show. Which do you prefer? Spooling it out from that remembered outline as you do on the show, or sitting down with the text? I guess I know the answer, but
I like the challenge of walking out on a stage with a microphone, and there's the audience all sitting out there with high expectations that cannot be met, and you sort of have at them. It's a greater challenge somehow. Sitting and reading it, I mean, what am I supposed to do while I'm reading it? It's interesting. I like it, but
you don't take a script out on that stage. You've got a sketch thing in the back of your mind, and you just spool off it.
Right. I mean, you have some sense of order and whatnot, but no, you don't want to have a script. It would just get in your way. But when a writer sits down and reads something out loud, he's correcting it in his own mind. You know, he's thinking, why serpentine? Why did I throw that in there?
So Latin.
It's a crooked road. Why not just crooked? And it's on the prairie. How can a road on the prairie be serpentine? This is a land of rectangles. Why?
Sounds like a Saab commercial. You know that painting where the road's going back and forth through the hills of not probably the prairie.
You know, the problem with that passage, that part of the passage, is that the guy is trying to be cinematic, isn't he? He's trying to draw a little motion picture scene.
Well, there you go. You touch Hollywood once, and now you're polluted.
There should have been more dialogue. I don't know. Anyway.
What's up with all the death, Garrison Keillor? It's all over the movie. It's all over this book. We've got angels taking everybody up, you know, into the mind of God.
Death was around before I got here, kid. I didn't bring it into the world with me.
Well, but there's a time when we just talk about, you know, I don't know, sap running and that sort of thing. You've got a pretty
what
big...
What running?
Sap.
Sap running?
I don't mean to talk dirty, but, you know, you
don't come from... I'm not from Vermont. We don't do that here.
Oh, the sap doesn't run in the...
Well, it runs. I guess it does. I mean, we try not to think about it.
I was thinking about, I don't know, the young loins of Lake Wobegonians.
Oh, loins. Oh, my gosh. Are we going to talk about that now?
Well, I asked about death. It seems like it's very prevalent and prominent in the movie, and here it's all over your book. Is it much on your mind, sir?
No, sir. Not on my mind. And if it's on your mind, I'm happy to talk about health care. But no, not particularly. But it gives you a story. It gives you a story, and it's necessary, I think, to have it. to do a story. Otherwise, we're just talking about youthful hijinks, and we're talking about pale loins, and you know, her hand reaching for yours across the table, and her knee brushing against your thigh, her young angular knee brushing against your chinos.
Mr. Keeler, would you introduce us a little further to your Evelyn and her daughter Barbara at the heart of this book?
Evelyn and her daughter. Evelyn is a steady Lutheran in Lake Wobegon. She's one of the quilters who get together every Tuesday night, I believe, and they crank out quilts, summer, fall, winter, spring. Everybody in town has more than one, so they bail them up and send them off to the needy somewhere. She was married to a difficult man, Jack Peterson, Uncle Jack, and after he died, things seemed to lighten up for her. She's kind of a woman of mystery. She's gone off gallivanting off to visit elderly relatives around the country, and only after her death does her daughter Barbara, who has her own troubles, a difficult marriage which has come to an end, a son launching out into the world who she loves more than she could ever say. Only when Evelyn dies, which she did in that scene that I read at the very beginning of the book, does Barbara start to figure out her own life. The mother makes room for the daughter, and the daughter grows up as she learns Evelyn's secrets. Evelyn's life becomes clear to her through a whole series of letters that she finds, and through her funeral arrangements. She does not want to be buried out of the Lutheran church with a Lutheran service and everybody singing Children of the Heavenly Father. Mm. She wants to be cremated wearing a green rhinestone dress that somebody named Raoul gave her in Branson, Missouri, and she wants her ashes to be disposed of in an interesting way. And all of these things lead Barbara to find out about her mother and thereby put her own life on track. She's a woman. Barbara is with a terrible Kahlua problem, and a Bailey's Irish Cream problem in the morning, adding it to your coffee.
Yeah, it's a little early.
Giving yourself a buzz, and the buzz becomes a kind of a steady hard vibration, and you wind up taking an early nap, and then making weepy phone calls to your friends and relatives who dread this. Barbara gets herself on track.
Can you remember when all this started burbling out? I mean, not just this book, but the whole long train. Did you have a morning where you woke up and pulled the plug and became a prairie savant, you know, where it just gurgled out and out and out, the story, the endless long story?
I'm not a savant. I'm just, you know, trying to keep up with the others. But it's a story. And it started with pieces. It started out with a monologue on the show way, way back when that just struck a chord with people. And more people came up to me and said, I really liked that story you told about the pontoon boat and all of those Lutheran ministers. And there were 25 of them, and they got onto an 18-foot pontoon boat with a barbecue in the stern, and they all got on because they were too polite for anybody to say, this is overloading this boat. You can't come.
And so on they went.
So they all went on, and the last person to step on noticed that his socks got wet, and this thing pulled away from the dock, and it was just barely afloat. They thought if they just got the motor going, you know, they'd get some momentum, and they'd be okay, you know, the way we do in our lives. We think if we just, you know, keep moving.
And on pontoon boats, they seem fairly harmless. You can drag just about the whole the living room furniture onto a pontoon
right,
boat.
Right, right, right. But the water was sloshing on the deck. Anyway, people liked that story, and I brought the pontoon boat back, and it just seemed to be something about buoyancy and staying afloat that touched a chord in people. So,
but this whole ocean,
I always do what other people want. So well, I discovered that, you know, that I should make that into a story.
But when did you figure out that there was apparently no bottom to this well? You could just keep throwing the bucket down there week after week after week, book after book, and up would come another story. Did you know
there's
that
a bottom?
The
there's a bottom.
Have
to
you
the
found
well.
It? Have
oh,
you ever found
goodness.
It?
Oh goodness, yes, yes. No, I've had embarrassing moments on a stage in front of people when. You know, when you just you sort of go blank, and there's not much for you to do. You just say, so there were, anyway. You say you toss the word anyway, and
yeah, and
anyway,
and dream right on through.
There were these two penguins, you know, on an ice floe, and one penguin looks at the other and says, "You look like you're wearing a tuxedo," and the other one says, "What makes you think I'm not?" And then after that, you think of something.
You have a biscuit, and off you go.
There's a, yeah.
May we bring in our callers? We've got a lot of them who want to speak with you.
Right, okay, sure.
Virginia Beach, Virginia. John, you're on the air with Garrison Keillor.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Garrison. It's a real pleasure to talk to you. I've enjoyed your radio show for many years.
Now, your real name is Virginia Beach?
I'm in Virginia Beach. John.
You're in your Virginia Beach. Well, so what does she think about that? Well, never mind.
what do you say, John?
What?
Well, I guess I know you've had a lot of reasons for your success, and one obviously is the voice. I mean, you've got that voice that reminds me of my mother rubbing honey and whiskey on my gums when I was a baby. It's sweet and just, you know, it's a great, great radio voice.
Your mother rubbed honey and whiskey on your gums?
When you were a baby, they rubbed a little honey and whiskey on your gums for the teething or the pain.
Chill out,
we don't do that. We don't do that in Minnesota. I don't think the pediatricians recommend whiskey and honey.
But, I got that for colds coming on. You say you hear that sweetness in the voice, John. What's your question for Garrison?
My question is, how many writers are involved with the show? Because they've got, you know, unique characters, unique writing and storytelling. How many actual writers are involved in the production of the show?
We have Sandy Beach, Natalie Dressed left. Sarah Bellum is kind of the main person right now. We have Guy Wire. We have Pete Moss. We added a new one, Laura Buchholz, this year. So I don't know, what does that make, six, seven?
Pete Moss and Sarah Bellum, do they just show up in your imagination, or do they, it sounds like a Car Talk credits line.
I don't know. I mean, I don't see them, but, you know, we get stuff. It comes in by email.
Do you sit around in the sitcom style and, you know, kick stuff around at the St. Paul backyards?
I don't. Maybe Sarah Bellum and Guy Wire and Pete Moss do, but I don't do that much.
John, have you got a beat on the number there?
It's a great show. That's all I can say.
Are you with us, John? Are you still?
I was trying to count, and I'm not sure, but thanks very much for that. Andrea is calling from Lexington, Massachusetts. Andrea, you're on the air.
Hi, Garrison. I'm a
Lexington.
Yes, I'm a displaced Minnesotan, though.
You don't sound like it, Andrea.
Oh, shucks. I've been out here too long.
No, say boat.
My O's come back when I go home.
Uh-huh.
But I just wanted to say that when my husband's Jewish, I'm a Minnesotan, so we're raising our children half Jewish, half Minnesotan.
We have Jews in Minnesota, just so you know.
Oh, yeah.
Lots
no,
of
joined,
them.
I joined a temple out here that had a rabbi Good. From Minnesota.
Good. All right. Fine. Good.
But I just wanted to say that I went to McAllister College,
yes.
And my first time seeing you, I was 12 years old, at the Minnesota Farm Campus.
Right.
That's a long time ago, maybe.
The Moo You.
It was about 30 years ago. Sorry to break the news to you.
Yeah, right. A lot of things were going on 30 years ago.
Including that.
Andrea.
Thanks very much for that. What about that duration, Garrison, about how long you've been doing it? For a while you stopped doing it and started up again. And does it change the way it feels? Keep on doing it and doing it?
What you're trying to ask, if I may just interpret your stuttering here.
I would love that.
Is why do you keep on doing this?
It's
an impolite question, but I accept it.
No, I
keep on doing it because I don't have anything else to do. I've been at this job so long that my job skills have atrophied or atrophied. I'm not sure. I no longer would be able to do any other kind of radio show than the kind that I do. I have no computer skills. Radio, I'm not sure if you're aware of this, is all kind of computerized and programmed now. And nobody does the kind of show that I did when I started out in radio. You had to load COBOL into the transmitter, you know, to get the thing up and moving. And there was a big flywheel that was turning, and an enormous long belt that ran. And
with the mule.
You had to lubricate the thing, and I just don't have job skills anymore. And I've been the boss of this show for all of these years, and being the boss, Tom, if I may call you Tom.
You may.
Means you lose your social skills.
Yeah, just do it.
Garrison says do it. This big honking guy in a suit. There's nothing else I can do. And I just don't feel like retirement. Thank you.
You kind of lost that panoply, but you do all kinds of things.
I did retirement. See, I did it when I was your age.
Well, why did you do it? And why did you come back?
I thought, why did I come back? Because retirement didn't work out for me.
Just rubbing honey and whiskey on your gums all day? And
I just, I thought I was going to be, I thought I was going to write a great American novel. Mm-hmm. And I just discovered that wasn't in the cards for me. To be able to sit in a room by yourself for 5 or 6 years and struggle and suffer just was not anything I could do.
Yeah, yeah.
And then have the outcome be something that was sort of crappy.
Could be, and you never know what they'd say about it. And you don't get to remake it every week.
No, that would be too painful.
Oh, anybody could understand it. Okay. May we take a call from Sam in Middleton, Massachusetts. Sam, you're on the air with Garrison Keillor.
Hi. I just want to say it's a huge honor to be able to talk to you, Mr. Keillor.
Sam of Middleton, yes.
Yes.
Yes, right. Likewise.
I was a big fan of the movie. Really, really, really enjoyed the movie. I thought it was one of the most beautiful movies I've seen in a very, very long time. And
I can't possibly mean that, but I thank you.
No, I honestly do mean that, although I am a big Robert Altman fan, too, so that probably had a little something to do with it.
Yeah.
I wanted to know if you were familiar, or how familiar you were with his work before you worked with him, and how the movie came about. I mean, did you go to him? Did he come to you? Was there a third person who came to both of you?
There were intermediaries who brought us together, and Mr. Altman was, if I recall, 79, when we first sat down. We had dinner in Chicago. He just finished making his movie Company about the Joffrey company in Chicago. And so he was all kind of excited from that, but he wanted to keep moving. Mr. Altman was a man who never intended to retire. He was a World War II bomber pilot, and he was going to go down. He was going to go down on a mission. That was his idea. And he wanted to get going on something right away. When you're 79, life is urgent. And he sized me up in the course of a dinner conversation. I wanted to make a movie about a small town in Minnesota full of Lutherans and Catholics. He had no interest in that whatsoever. But he wanted to come see the show, and he did. He came to the show 2-3 times, and he sat backstage, and he decided that's what he wanted to do. He was a man in a hurry. And he wanted to make a backstage fictional documentary, I think was the term he used. But he just wanted to do backstage at a radio show. He'd grown up with radio in Kansas City. He was very fond of it. He was very fond of musicians, and so that appealed to him enormously. And he told me to write the script, and I did. I wrote a script for him. It wasn't anything I would have written, and that's how that came about.
Did he have an idea of what he wanted the movie to be about beyond just being backstage, or did he just give
you
free rein?
No. He gave me free rein, but I ran drafts of the screenplay by him. He looked at them. He didn't want to comment on specific things, but he said, here are these sisters, these Johnson sisters. You've got something here. Go with that. And I think he was starting to cast it in his own mind. And he wanted Lily Tomlin in it. He'd worked with her before, of course, and then Meryl Streep was interested in doing something with him, so he started to put this together in his own mind, and he was kind of shaping it, just in his own encouraging way.
Garrison Keillor joins us from Minneapolis, and right now Eric is calling from Fort Drum, New York. Eric, you're on the air with Garrison Keillor.
Tom, Garrison, I'm calling from Fort Drum, New York, and I just wanted to tell you guys, I appreciate you giving me the opportunity. Garrison, I've loved everything you've done since I've been listening, and the one point I wanted to make was, through all the deployments we've had, being one of the most deployed divisions in the Army, my parents started sending me your tapes and your books, and I tell you, nothing reminds me more of being at home than reading your books and listening to your shows.
Eric, can you paint a picture for us of where you, when you were deployed, I don't know, was it Iraq? Where were you? What would it look like when you were listening to Garrison on the tape?
Actually, my last deployment, we were in Iraq. Previously, I was in Afghanistan. And, I'd come back at night, lay down, and I'd put the tape in. I brought a tape player over with me, and I'd just lay there after a patrol or whatever and listen to the tapes. And, I grew up in a large Lutheran community in Northeast Ohio, and I tell you, it'd make all the bad men go away and take me home for a little bit. So I just want to tell Garrison how much I appreciate it.
Eric, stick with us.
I appreciate that, Eric.
Yeah, what do you say?
But you didn't. You went to sleep, Eric. Be truthful with us now. You dozed off. You went to sleep, didn't you?
Well, I tried to.
I put you to sleep, Eric.
I wouldn't make it through more than about maybe 10, 15 minutes of the tape, but, I'd always rewind and start over.
Well, you see, that's the thing that you accomplish in radio that you weren't intending to accomplish when you went into radio, is that you develop this voice that becomes so familiar that people relax and they go to sleep, and I've come to terms with it. That's all.
Well, from what one of the previous questions and one of the previous callers said, Garrison, you do what you like and like what you do, and when you stop liking what you do, then I guess it's time to call it quits.
All right. Well,
but
I wish you well.
I wanted to say thank you to you, and I appreciate it.
I thank you. I wish you well, my man.
Eric, right. Thank you very much for your call. Good luck. Garrison Keillor, do you set out to be a comfort to people or a prod? I mean, in your columns, you can get pretty prickly.
Oh, can I? Oh.
Yeah.
Good. I'm glad I'm still capable of that.
Mm-hmm.
I hope to work on that even more as I get older. We hope so, too. You run the risk of becoming beloved, and
it's already a one-way street. Well, you're on it. So what do you do you fear being too comforting? Do you want to be comforting?
No, I don't. I want to make sense, and sometimes making sense means that you touch people in a place they don't want to be touched, and that just happens. If you are a writer and you never make anybody angry, this is not a good sign. Somehow you've become a little bit too comfortable. Writers are not dedicated to a single purpose, I think. Mm-hmm. You sit down to write, and that's what I do. I'm not a performer. I'm a writer. You sit down to write, and it is a moment of complete freedom in your life, which otherwise is just as constricted as anybody else's, maybe more so. But you sit down and you feel free. And freedom oftentimes leads us to things that other people wish we wouldn't go to.
Oh, we're glad you do. What about mm-hmm. Lake Wobegon? Do you get sick of it? You've got a character in this book who really lays into it. Debbie Detmers, the wild child mm-hmm. that went away to California. Mm-hmm. She says that you write having her say, "They say that God is love, but nobody believed it for a minute. It, mm-hmm. Lake Wobegon, was a culture of fussy women and silent, angry men and horrified mm-hmm. children. It was a pool of negativity, Lake Wobegon. People who believed in disappointment, especially in marriage, and on mm-hmm. and on. Mm-hmm. It doesn't sound like everybody above average and one happy family."
Well, she'd been away for a long time, you know, so she was looking at this through the lens of her own teenage angst. And that's not the best. That's not the best lens. But she mellowed when she came back, and in the end, she dumps her California boyfriend yeah. because he is impolite to her parents. You see, she allows herself to be critical of Lake Wobegon, but when outsiders would be. Him, for example, mm-hmm. he. Mm-hmm. Then she gets her back up.
And that won't
she
do.
And she would defend this town. Same with me. I can be very acerbic about Minnesota, but if one of you sniffy Bostonians came out here and laid into Minneapolis,
watch out.
That's all I can say. Just look out.
Look out, baby. Barbara's calling.
Why are we just talking about me? Why aren't we talking about you and this show and On Point? I mean, there's an interesting title. I mean, where did that come from?
It just soared up through the meringue clouds and into the mind of God.
Usually about dance or what is this about?
Pretty much. Yeah, it's usually
it's
a ballet.
Is your real last name? I mean, I've heard rumors that your real last name is Anderson and that Ashbrook is kind of an attempt to sound more Eastern.
I've got Swedes in the woodpile, and you know, so you could be on to something there. Yeah, they were, in my grandfather's generation, it was Ivar, mm-hmm. Arto, Hulda, Yarda, Olga. So, I've been there. Let's take a call from Barbara in Chesapeake, Virginia. Barbara,
you're on the air. Don't want to talk about that anymore. Okay, all
right. Hi, Tom. Hi, Garrison.
Hi. Hello.
I have what I hope is a simple question. Have to settle a family dispute. Although I guess there's no other simple answer to family disputes. But anyways, I am married to a family of Lutheran Minnesotans. Well, one of them, but you get the whole family with it. And they are from Painesville, which is in Stearns County on Lake Corona. Mm-hmm. And when we first got married, everybody was very irritating the family that the triangulations of latitude and longitude essentially put it right there. Lake Wobegon is Lake Corona, Stearns County. But I have noticed in the last couple of years when I go back in the summer with everybody that now Stearns County Community Visitor Guides and the Painesville Press proudly claims Painesville and Lake Coronis and Stearns County as the true Lake Wobegon.
So they started out embarrassed or irritated, and now they've taken it as their own.
15 years, and so I essentially just want to settle it. First they said, nah, 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 nah. You know, I can't make the noise that they make. And by the way, they all do play, you know, brass and woodwind instruments.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I said, I just wanted to settle it from the horse's mouth. Is it Stearns? Is it Painesville? Is it Lake Coronis with First Island, Second Island, and Third Island?
Mr. Keeler.
Lake Wobegon is the county seat of Mist County, M-I-S-T County, which is a county that does not appear on the maps of Minnesota because of a cartographer's nightmare back after the Civil War, where teams of surveyors moved in from the corners of the state towards the middle, and they got it wrong. And so they had to fold over their map in the middle, and Lake Wobegon wound up on the bottom flap. So, no, it's not Painesville, though people from Lake Wobegon go to Lake Coronis. It's kind of – Painesville is like a resort town to people from Lake Wobegon. And you can see movies in Painesville that you would not want people in Lake Wobegon to know that you were interested in. So they shop there and they go there. But no, it's not. It is not Painesville or Coronis. They know all of those Stearns County towns, Avon and Albany and Freeport and Sauk Center. But no, it's a little bit north of there.
We hope that settles it, Barbara. Cullen's calling. Hi, Cullen. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Garrison.
Hi. Hello.
Hi. I like your work.
Thank you.
Yes.
Be cool.
I had a question. Thank you. I had a question about a story you wrote years ago about the going to see the Tabernacle Tent Revival preacher, Brother Bob.
Yeah, right.
I wondered, I started thinking about that story right now because of the hypocrisy that we see right now, and Brother Bob certainly was a huge hypocrite. I wondered where that character came from. Was that a real person, or was that just kind of a general comment on the hypocrisy of those who cast stones so liberally?
Brother Bob was, of course, a hypocrite. We all are, but he was a sympathetic character in my story, and his hypocrisy was what made him a sympathetic character. He was a ferocious gospel preacher. I went as a child. And under tremendous inner pressure, I went forward to accept Jesus, and he took me in his arms, and he prayed for me. And that was an amazing sensation, to have him put his arms around me. And when he did, I smelled whiskey on his breath. And I felt that to be in the arms of a drunk who is praying for you is an experience that I would spend the rest of my life trying to figure out. And that's the truth. Hypocrite, yes. I wouldn't accuse him of that without accusing myself.
Cullen, thanks for calling. Gersky, let me ask you about a couple of things. I don't know. Tomorrow's 9/11. What do you think about 9/11 these days?
What do I think about 9/11? I think that it happened a number of years ago, and it was accompanied by a great deal of genuine grief, much of it private, on the part of people who lost people. And then it was exploited, and it was exploited in ways that we can disagree about, but it surely was. I was in New York. I was up around 90th and Riverside, a few miles north of Ground Zero. And for me, it was a very different experience than it was for people just like me who happened to be going to the Twin Towers that day. And they have a right to that difference. It was entirely different for them, and I have no right to that experience. That's my feeling. There was a lot of talk about how, you know, the country would never be the same again. The country is the same, except that for some reason the Constitution has been put off to the side. But we'll get it back. We'll get it back.
Here's another. What do you expect from General Petraeus tomorrow? How do you feel about the whole drama of this progress report on Iraq?
It's not a drama. They're playing out parts that have already been written for them, and there's nothing surprising to come out of that. All of the lines are going to be, exactly what you would expect people to say. We seem frozen with this war, and we need another election in order to resolve this. This is a political. This is a political problem. This is not a military problem.
What do you say about Larry Craig, the senator from Idaho, got arrested up in your neck of the woods, of course, in the so-called sexting in the airport bathroom?
Well, it's a very complicated story, isn't it? And we don't really know the story. I mean, at first blush, it's tremendously funny, and people got a big kick out of it. I'm sure that that was painful to him. Nobody cares to be a joke, but he became a punchline. And now I think it's mostly all over and gone. Water under the bridge and over the dam.
Let's get one last call. Larry in Aiken, South Carolina. You're on the air with Garrison Keillor.
Hi, Garrison. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Garrison, if there's such a word, I'm a Lake Wobegonian.
Mm-hmm.
And I graduated from Anoka Senior High in 1962, a little bit after you.
That's Garrison's hometown. Mm-hmm.
Yes. I was back there a couple months ago for class reunion, and I noticed that the prairie is built up.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if in the future you had thoughts of maybe writing something about Lake Wobegon and beyond. Those were my first thoughts when I drove through Anoka.
You mean what happens when the suburbs come to Lake Wobegon? Sprawl.
Yeah. I left because of the cold winters, and now they're not so cold. But I think one of the reasons the people stay in Minnesota is because it's very secure. I saw most of the friends that were still there. There was only a few of us that had left. But it's always so rewarding to go back and put your feet on what America really is and was.
Larry, our time's short. Let me take it to your high school mate, Garrison. Does Lake Wobegon ever get, you know, built up with subdivisions and roll away in a heat wave?
I think I've put it beyond the megalopolis, and I don't think the sprawl is going to get that far. Of course, out there in the country, people are scrabbling to make a living because agriculture has just changed so dramatically and continues to change dramatically. And so people are struggling, and many people are willing to commute unthinkable lengths of time to get to a paying job. It's something I can't quite imagine, but people do it. So I'll have to deal with it at some point.
Warming up a little, lilacs coming a little earlier in the season.
Yes, sir.
Garrison Keillor, the new book is Pontoon. Thanks for all you do. Keep doing it. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, now.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
All the world, it's a world.